We are continuing our study on studying the Bible chronologically. We have finished up our study of Genesis. We're trying to get things moving along, so we've finished Genesis for the most part. Now we're going to move on to the Exodus. One thing I want to emphasize as we begin is we won't know everything. We can't know everything. One of the things as I was doing the book of Genesis is I could never quite figure out when Benjamin was born. Was Benjamin born before Joseph went into Egypt, or was he born after he went into Egypt? There seems to be evidence both ways. We see that Benjamin was, when Benjamin was born, Rachel had died. Joseph had his dreams, at some point, Jacob said, "Hey, will your father, your brothers, and your mother, will all of us bow before you?" Now, perhaps he had those dreams long before he was sent off into Egypt, but there's still that question. There's the question of the fact that he's called a lad, a boy, which usually identifies someone between birth and around 20 years old. He's identified as that when Jacob, the sons of Jacob, other sons of Jacob, go to Egypt to see Joseph. So, and then when they enter into Egypt, he has 10 sons. So, was he 20 or was he, how old was he? Was he born, there's the age difference, 17 to 39, 22 years, Joseph was gone. So, he had to have been older than 22 if he was born before Joseph left. So, there's that question, when was Benjamin born? Who knows? Seems to be a lot of evidence both ways. Maybe they described lad as someone who was maybe a little bit older than 20. Who knows? I want to emphasize that real quick. Next question: how long was Israel in Egypt?
That's what
they say. There's a lot of questions about that. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 15. We'll start there. I know we finished Genesis, but these two books are connected. Genesis 15 and verse 13. This is when Abraham is talking with God and God makes a promise to him. Will someone read that, verse 13? Yes.
Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years.
All right, so this is a prophecy talking about 400 years. Let us then go to Exodus chapter 12. And verse 40, this is as the Israelites are leaving the land of Egypt.
"Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years.
Okay, so is it 400? Is it 430? Now let's go to Galatians chapter 3. And look at verse 16 and 17.
"Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to your seed who is Christ. And this I say, that the law which was 430 years later cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by God in Christ that it should make the promise of no effect.
Okay, so we have another instance of 430 years. What were the instances that Paul is talking about here? That 430-year span of time.
Talking about from the confirmation of the covenant with Abraham.
Okay.
Which actually gets reconfirmed with Isaac and Jacob, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. All the way to when? The giving of the law,
right?
Giving
of the law, right.
At Mount Sinai. So we start with making the promise and his seed. So that makes it about 400, 430 years. The prophecy was a round figure in Genesis chapter 12. But 430 years given here in Galatians seems to be a contradiction with the 430 years in Exodus. Because Exodus sounds like they're talking about they've been in Egypt for 430 years. But here he's talking about from Egypt, being not in Egypt, but having the promise to giving of the law. So, how do we reconcile that?
And you don't have Genesis 28? I was just looking at Genesis 28:13. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. So this is Jacob, right? The land on which you lie, I will give to your descendants, and your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, shall spread abroad to the east, north, west, east, north, and south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. This is where he confirms the same covenant. So this is Jacob, sometime in Jacob's life, right? I mean, it's, if I remember right, this is Bethel, and he's in Bethel. So it's within Jacob's lifetime that the last covenant confirmation took place. And, of course, Jacob ended up in Egypt.
So. I think a lot of people will point to this and say that it's talking about what happened in Genesis 17, where that confirmation or that first covenant was made. Whatever the case, we don't know. We don't know. But I do want to look again at Exodus chapter 12. And verse 40. I want to look at that again. How many of you have the New King James Version? Okay. Is there a footnote that you have for that verse?
What is the verse?
Exodus 12:40. All right. My footnote says, the Samaritan Pentateuch and Septuagint read Egypt and Canaan. So some versions say that they were in Egypt and Canaan for 430 years, which would account for the difference in the versions between here and in Galatians. One other thing, he talks about a sojourn. What is a sojourn?
Travel,
yeah. So traveling around, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were in Egypt for 430 years, but they ended up in Egypt. In fact, it says, now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt. Currently, they are living in Egypt, but they didn't always live in Egypt. So the sojourn, their travel of those who currently lived in Egypt was 430 years. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we have 430 years of them being in Egypt. Does that make sense? All right. Excellent. Excellent. So, now the question remains, how long were they in Egypt? We still have that question. So, there is some speculation. Some say about 260 years, 270 years, something to that effect. So we'll trying to date these things exactly. I think I'll try to do that a little later on. But right now, I want to try to look at Egyptian history a little bit and try to sync up what we see in Scripture with what we know of Egyptian history. Now, here's one thing I want to make clear. This is the Egyptian timeline, traditional Egyptian timeline. That doesn't necessarily mean that's set in stone. Now, a lot of Egyptian historians will say it is set in stone. This is how these things are divided. But this is based off of a dynasty list that was made at around this time period, a little bit after this time period. So this is thousands of years away from some of these other things. So how do we know how accurate that is? Well, we know. But there's so much speculation with when these things occurred. The traditional historic date for, well, first, who was the pharaoh of the Exodus? Let me ask that question. Any guesses? What do the movies say?
Ramses. See, somebody in the middle says Ramses.
The movies say that it's Ramses, right? And that's actually the traditional view. That's what, I don't mean in Christendom, but that's what a lot of historians will say was the pharaoh during the Exodus. And here's why. Take a look at Exodus chapter 1 and verse 11. This is when the slavery begins and the Israelites are tasked with building two cities, two storehouse cities, or supply cities, as my version says. So what's that say?
Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities,
Python and Ramses. So we have the name Ramses right here. So they're not going to name a city if there's not already a pharaoh. Well, all right. Let's go back to Genesis 47, verse 11. Is this before the Exodus, Genesis 47? Yeah, before the Exodus. Do you suppose that would be the same pharaoh? No, because in Exodus chapter 1, he says, there arose a pharaoh who did not know Joseph. And in Genesis 47, that pharaoh knew Joseph. So, what does that say? Genesis 47, verse 11.
And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded.
So this is the land of Ramses. This name already existed in the time of Joseph. Now, what does Ramses mean? Now, there's a different spelling, as you might have noticed, between this Ramses and the Ramses of Exodus 1. Well, for some reason, it's different in English, but they're actually the same word in Hebrew. And what it means in Egyptian, do you recognize the first two letters, R-A? Do you know what the Egyptian sun god's name is?
Ra.
Ra. It means child or son of the sun. Now, don't you suppose that would be a common name back then, trying to honor their pagan deities? Well, yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of relatively a common name. Ramses II is the Ramses that's considered the pharaoh of the Exodus. There was a Ramses I, but he didn't quite make it to coronation. Some lists include him, some don't. One thing I'll go ahead and say, I do not claim to be an Egyptian history expert. I just did a lot of research this week, and I will not be able to answer all your questions on Egyptian history. I did try, anyway, to put something together on this. All right, so if it's not Ramses, the reason why we want to try to stay away from Ramses, let's look at 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1. What's the context of 1 Kings chapter 6? Do we know? Solomon is building the temple. That's exactly right. All right, 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1. Whoever's got that?
And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord.
All right. So the beginning of the temple, this is the fourth year of Solomon's reign. A lot of historians will peg this year as 966 BC. I've seen some dates that are fluctuate around that a little bit, but that's generally where that is. So 480 years before that is 1446 BC, which actually takes place in the early part of the New Kingdom. Ramses II is in the later part of the New Kingdom. And so he's much later, in 1200, something like that. And so what a lot of historians will do is they will look at the time of Ramses because of these verses, because of the mentions of Ramses. They won't consider what Solomon had to say or what's in 1 Kings chapter 6. They won't consider that. They'll look only at this part of Ramses, and they'll try to look and try to find archaeological evidence for the Exodus at around the time of Ramses, and they find none. Because that's not when it happened. Now, I want to jump down and talk a little bit about Jericho. Jericho, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho. Joshua chapter 2 is when they meet Rahab and the spies. Joshua chapter 6 is when Jericho is conquered. The reason why I want to talk about this is because this happens 40 years, right, after the Exodus. And so people can look at this event and try to peg when the Exodus occurred. And so that's why I'm talking about this at this point. So, yes, go ahead.
Well, I thought they had the Exodus and then they were wandering around the desert for 40 years.
Right. So 40 years before Jericho. So what happened is when the Exodus is supposed to have occurred. So we have the Exodus, they wander around in the desert for 40 years, then they go to the promised land and start conquering, and the first place that they get to is Jericho. Alright, so what happens is there have been a lot of excavations of where they believe Jericho to have been. And here are the things that they found, okay? They find that they used to have walls, right? Big walls that they had fallen down in front of the city. Instead of someone attacking, you would expect them to attack and the walls to have fallen inward. But instead, they fall outward. Okay, so there's that. They find a lot of grain in the city. A lot of grain that had been scorched, and a lot of scorch marks all over the place. What happens after Jericho, the walls come tumbling down? They scorch the city. And it was a short siege right after spring because they just had the Passover. And so they still have grain. It wasn't a long siege. They didn't eat up all the grain. So that's still there. And here's the kicker. There's one section of the wall that remains intact, or that remained intact, which indicates where Rahab was. But they date it a couple hundred years before they believe the Exodus occurred. Here's a question. If you have all that evidence to tell us, or that matches so closely with what we see in the book of Joshua, but your timing is off, what do you think you need to correct? Your timing.
Right.
Your timing. So, it's a funny thing. There's just so much evidence that points to this particular event. So, and I just wanted to do that, say that to you, and partly to build your faith on that too, because these things can be found historically. There's also evidence, archaeological evidence, that a large Semitic population lived in Egypt during the Middle Kingdom, and then suddenly vanished. Now, again, that sounds a lot like what we read in the Bible, right? Semitic is the Israelites, right? So they find the Semitic population in the Middle Kingdom, and then they vanish. Now, what do you suppose happens after all those plagues, after all the firstborn in your land die, and after your army is demolished in the Red Sea? What do you suppose happens to a nation when all that happens?
Revolution.
The economy collapses. Mm-hmm. They're open to attack. We see in Exodus, I didn't look this up beforehand, but I read it last night, where the people are like, don't you know? There it is. Exodus 10:7. Then Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? Pharaoh is so blinded with pride and arrogance that he can't see what's right in front of him. And that is so evident with his not willing to let the Israelites go. So he can't even see that his own country is being destroyed. Or it says here, is destroyed. So that leads some to believe that this spawns the end of the Middle Kingdom. The second intermediate period arrives. There's a people that are called the Hyksos that comes into Egypt and takes over. And they are hated by the Egyptians once the Egyptians take over again for the new kingdom. So could the plagues of Egypt have, and the destruction of the army left them vulnerable to attack so that the Hyksos could come in and take over? Possibly. Possibly. One thing I want to point out as well is that there are so many theories out there about who the Pharaoh is, when the timing of these things occurred, and it's very interesting reading. I mean, you can fall down a rabbit hole so quickly trying to figure out which Pharaoh is which and where goes with what. But I want to point out that sometimes these things fit so perfectly in the minds of the people creating these theories that it's got to be that. Mm-hmm. Well, what if it's not? What if you find something that doesn't quite fit, or maybe it could fit in this other situation? So I presented one theory about the end of the Middle Kingdom. That's possible. If that's the case, then the Pharaoh of Joseph is Sesostris the first. The Sesostris the third starts Egyptian slave or Israelite slavery. Amenemhat the third finds Moses, and Neferhotep the first is the Pharaoh during the Exodus. That's that theory. Another theory, what if it happens during the Hyksos dynasty? So there's another possibility. Perhaps it happened during the Hyksos. Perhaps there was a fall that had nothing to do with the Israelites, and the Hyksos, didn't know Joseph and thought, okay, well, I don't know Joseph, so I'm going to enslave these people. Maybe. So that could have happened then. All right, so that's one possibility. And there's not a lot of records about the Hyksos dynasty, so I can't say who was who at that time. All right. Next, possibly, the Hyksos rule ends, and maybe they start slavery in the New Kingdom. The first pharaoh of the New Kingdom is Ahmos the First. Moses was born under Amenhotep the First, and further slavery continues under Thutmose the Second when Moses flees to Midian. And then Thutmose the Third is the pharaoh during the Exodus. Now, there's a lot of theories that fit that as well. Thutmose the Third, his name, his full name, if you want to look at it more in depth, is Thutmoses. The other pharaoh is Ahmoses. So you see that, is there a similarity in name here? Perhaps Ahmos and Thutmose were related, but maybe they brought Moses up out of the river, and maybe they named him Moses as well. It kind of fits along with that. Another possibility, or another thing that fits with this, Thutmose the Third is he had 17 campaigns before a certain period of time, and then he suddenly stops. Could his army have been wiped out because of that? So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that fits all these things. I think the only thing that we can know for sure is that the pharaoh of the Exodus was not Ramses II. And all these people that I was looking at are believers. They are, well, and then some were not, so I could try to see what the counter-arguments were. And that's basically what I want to say about that.
So, you gave a really good example of the one in Chronicles, or Kings, when Solomon in it. In a lot of these theories have developed over a long period of time. They didn't develop, some of those theories developed long before people had things like internet search engines to look up every single verse that has this. It doesn't mean that they knew where all the verses were. They would sometimes put more weight on one than the other, which you brought up. And anytime somebody tries to piece together the puzzle when you don't have all the pieces, and in fact some of the pieces are really far away and you don't have nothing in between them, everybody kind of gets a theory and tries to hook them together. And so, one of the things that I know Gilbert used to always say this is, people say, well, scholars say, okay, well, how many scholars agree with each other?
Yeah.
there's lots and lots and lots of different interpretations. It's interesting to try to figure it out. Other simple things is, Moses is writing this at the end, right? He's not writing it right as it happens. He's not recording it. He's writing it later. He also says in some of the early parts of Christianity, he says, oh, by the way, we call this now.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nothing saying that the words and the phrases he was using at the time were the historical term for it as much as it was, hey, by the way, this land over here that we call this now? That's where that was happening.
There's an example we see throughout the book of Genesis. Do you remember where Jacob has his vision of the ladder to heaven? Or the stairway to heaven, however you want to call it. Remember where that happened?
That's Bethel, isn't it?
That was Bethel. He called it Bethel, which
right.
Literally means house of God.
House of God. Right.
So he called it Bethel. What was it before? The land of Luz. It's the land of Luz. And so we can see, even all the way far back, I think in Genesis 47, he calls it the land of Luz.
Mm-hmm.
That I had this vision. So, and earlier, before Luz is mentioned, or before he has that vision, it's called Bethel. But that's because Moses is using the same names that that his current readership would know. This is the land of Bethel. This is where that occurred. So we see these, what some might call an anachronism. Well, that's not really, because it's when he was writing. He was calling things as he knew them. and as his readership would be familiar with. It's like saying that Abraham was born in Iraq. Well, he wasn't really born in Iraq, was he? Iraq didn't come until much later. But he was born in the area that we now call Iraq. So, there's all that, that kind of thing. All right. I have the Hebrew calendar over there, which I think is pretty interesting, and that will help us date a lot of these things later on. But before I get to that, I want to talk about this section here. I kind of fit that in there somehow, and hopefully it comes out. We have, at some point, archaeologists decided that there were going to be three ages of mankind. The Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. Before the Stone Age takes place, a lot of it in what they call prehistorical times. Now I have a question. Is there such thing as prehistory?
It depends on whether you consider history being what happened or history being records that we have of it.
There is no such thing as prehistory. No such thing as a prehistorical era, because we have things written down as history from the very beginning. So there is no such thing as prehistory. So we have the there's one more thing I want to mention. Who still has their timeline that I handed out last week? What is the time that the BC time that I give for the flood?
2370.
When did that, where does that fit in here in the Egyptian timeline?
In the Old Kingdom.
In the Old Kingdom. So was there an Egyptian kingdom and then the flood happened and then they immediately go back and start over? No. No. Now, I admit my timing for the flood, you know, there's some error bars. There's because we're not sure how long the Exodus was exactly. So we have some leeway there, but it's not going to be much different than the day I have there. So it's got to happen. So that shows that this timeline is just a little bit off, right? It's not going to be over 1,000 years off, or nearly 1,000 years off. So there's some leeway there. That shows us that the traditional Egyptian timeline is not entirely accurate. It's based, they're not looking to the Bible to see, oh, well, it couldn't have been here, so I need to rework my timeline. They're coming up with theirs apart from what the Bible says. All right, so with the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age, there's some interesting passages in the book of Joshua and the book of Judges that kind of will help us time these things. Let's look at Joshua 17, verses 16 through 18.
The children of Joseph said, "The mountain country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those who are of Beth Shean and those and its towns and those who are of the valley of Jezreel." And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You are a great people and have great power, and you shall not have only one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you can cut it down, and its farthest extent shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong."
Why is having an iron chariot such a big deal?
It wouldn't fall apart. You were crashing around with horses dragging it over rocks.
You can move faster than you can on foot.
Okay. But why? I'm trying to focus on the iron part.
Iron Age.
Iron Age, exactly.
That's a lot of iron.
That is a lot of iron.
Yeah.
And so the Iron Age is characterized by heavy use of iron. And so we can see that the Israelites and the Egyptians at this time, roughly around this time, were using predominantly bronze. And so we have this clash between different technologies. It's like going up against an army of tanks when all you have are horses.
Right.
You have this different technology, and now everybody's got to catch up in order to compete in terms of strength. And he says, even though they have chariots of iron, you should be able to conquer them. What happens in Joshua, though? Do they conquer?
Mm-hmm. Eventually.
They conquer a lot of places, but do they complete the conquest of Canaan? They do not. They do not. So, in Judges 1, verse 19, what does that say?
So the Lord is with Judah. And they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron.
So in Joshua, he says that they can, even though they have chariots of iron. But here in Judges, they can't.
But they're different tribes, too. One's Judah, one's Ephraim and Manasseh. There's different size armies and all kinds of things.
Right. So my point is, the difference between what happens with Joshua and Judges is the fact that in between this time frame, they don't finish conquering the land. And they are told that there will be, that the people of Canaan will not be completely vanquished, and they will remain a snare to you throughout your generations. So that's true. We find that out to be the case. But I have a question. So I have up here Genesis 4:22. Yeah, let's go to that now. I don't think I need to preface it too much. What is Genesis 4? What's the context of that? Is that before or after the flood? Before the flood. All right. So Genesis 4:22. Whoever's got that.
Isabella, she also bare Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron, and the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah.
All right. So we see that Tubal-Cain was already very proficient in bronze and iron, a craftsman. How long do you suppose Tubal-Cain lived? If he lived as long as some of his other relatives, he lived a really long time, and he had an opportunity to hone these skills and to do all these things with bronze and iron. So iron was no new thing. We see that, in fact, throughout a lot of places in the first five books of the Old Testament, how iron is used in a lot of different ways. But it wasn't until around the time of Joshua, or Judges, rather, that iron starts to be used in weaponry. Now, it could have been used with Tubal-Cain, but there's no
there's a couple
direct
of things
evidence
to
of
think
that.
About there, too. Let's say there was a whole culture that used iron before the flood. All that skill got wiped
it's
out.
Gone.
And all that experience got wiped out. And even knowing where the iron was anymore got wiped out. There's a reason why the Hittites show up in where they were in north of Israel. Is they had iron, and historically, that's one of the first places where they found a lot of iron and they were able to use it. It takes a long, you know, you can't just say, great, we want to have iron chariots. Sure, grab some iron around here and let's make them.
Yeah.
You know, the iron's 1,000 miles away over two different countries with hostile armies. You can't move technology that fast in these days. So you could have, there were small amounts of iron and they knew how to use it, but then they didn't have enough coal, for instance, to smelt it. They had a hard time getting enough heat to break it down out of the rock.
Right.
So lots of intertwinings of technology would be required to make enough iron to, like, say, build a chariot. And,
right.
And that's probably part of it, too, is even though iron might have been known, being able to manufacture a fleet of iron chariots is a much bigger problem.
We see that they really faced it in the time of Deborah. In Judges chapter 4, where King Jabin and his army comes with chariots of iron. And eventually, was Jabin defeated? Oh yeah, oh yeah. But it did, it took some creative things that happened there. We'll talk about that later. All right. Any questions before we close out? All right. Next time, I think I'll talk about the Hebrew calendar a little bit more. We didn't really talk about it much, and some of the ages talked about in Exodus 6. I would like to look at as well. All right. Very good.